The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
What this was a system that allowed the NSA to own the networks of Iraq. They were able to intercept every cell phone call, every text message, every email, all of the content, all of the metadata. And what they did with this was to start to build a picture of how these insurgents were communicating via their networks. So there was a SIGINT, you know, kind of signals intelligence component to it. But more than that, they broke into these networks. They did things like sending text messages to individual fighters that appeared to come from fighters whom they knew, directing them to say, meet us, you know, effectively on this corner at such and such a time. And when they got there, they were greeted by U.S. troops and they were captured. Implanting spyware in websites and in forums that jihadis were known to use and also al-Qaeda in Iraq, so that their computers would become infected and could be turned into beacons so that we could actually track these guys down with combat forces.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, November 15th. 2014. That's the voice of Shane Harris you've just heard, senior correspondent at the Daily Beast and author of the new book, At War. That's @WAR. He was guest number one on the Lawfare podcast, and now it's episode 100, and he's back to celebrate our 100th episode by talking cyber war, the development of U.S. cyber capability, and our cyber vulnerabilities. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 100. That's 10 squared, 100. Shane Harris, At War. So tell us about the book. What's it about?
So the book is At War, The Rise of the Military Internet Complex. I suppose in some ways it's a little bit of a sequel to my first book, which also had the rise in the title, The Watchers, The Rise of America.
Are we going to go on to the falls?
We need a fall book. We need one more rise for a three-peat and then a fall. So the rise and fall. We could do it at the same time. but basically this is a book that I think ultimately tells the story of how it is that cybersecurity became sort of a national security fixation for the United States. And it really handles that story in two parts. One is looking at the offensive side of cybersecurity, how the United States has developed an elite cadre of hackers to break into other countries' computer systems, how we use cyber warfare very effectively in Iraq, how corporations are increasingly becoming very adept at what I think you might say is approaching the line of offensive cyber activity. And the second part is sort of also looking at the defensive side of that. So how are American computer systems vulnerable? What does that mean for the way that the NSA and the military and the Homeland Security Department are responding? And what I try and do in the book is really say, what does it matter to you? So how is the fact that government and their corporate partners, what I kind of refer to as the military internet complex, are changing cyberspace in their efforts to dominate cyberspace as a battlefield and to treat it as such? And why should we care? And how does that change the internet for all of us?
And so why should we care? And how does that change the internet for all of us?
I'm so glad you asked. One reason we should care, obviously, it's very interesting. And for your listeners, they're going to find, I think, a lot in this book to chew over about the legal implications of cyber war and hacking back and active defense and all these things that I know that they're really familiar with and that we've talked about on the show before. But my sort of central argument is that principally the NSA being the center of gravity, I guess if you like, in cybersecurity in the U.S., or at least for the government, and their quest to prepare the cyber battlefield, I argue that they are fundamentally making the internet less safe and less secure for all of us in some important ways. One of which is encryption. I write about in the book about some things we've known before about the undermining of encryption standards, but I go into sort of more of an argument in the book for why I think that is, something that undermines security for individuals in terms of their communications, their financial transactions. I think the NSA's compiling of zero-day exploits is arguably something that is undermining security on the internet. But also why we should care is this is the way that we're going to be fighting wars in the future. I mean, cyber is going to be, I think, in the next decade will sort of take its place alongside conventional force in the air and at sea, land as another way that we fight. And I think that's something that we all have a stake in and we all have to understand, because this isn't just sort of a cool thing that we do every now and then. This is something that is being integrated into military doctrine eventually.
So this issue of undermining the security of the internet is one of the issues I talked to Chris Segoyan about couple weeks ago. It seems to me to be a circle that's very hard to square if you are, an intelligence agency devoted both to signals intelligence and to information assurance. But even if you split those functions, the U.S. government still, A, has to protect its own signals, and B, steal other people's signals. Do you have, you say that we're sort of undermining the security of the internet. What's the alternative that doesn't create, that doesn't hopelessly compromise one interest of the government at the expense of the other?
Yeah. I don't know that there is an alternative that serves everyone's interest. And I thought that the conversation that you and Chris had was terrific. It was seriously one of the best episodes I think you guys have done in a while. And there's this implicit, this inexorable tension, right? In one agency, you have two missions that are sort of working at odds against each other. The vulnerabilities equities process, I think that is going on right now. This process by which zero-day flaws and exploits that the agency is collecting or discovering and will decide whether or not to disclose them. That seems to me like a framework that could work. But, of course, the national security exemption that's in that, I think as Chris put it, is like the exception that swallows the rule, right? So, I mean, the calibration there may be off, but it seems to me that the framework is at least a good start. I mean, I'm not persuaded that the mission of being able to have access to systems for the offensive component of NSA, should universally trump the defensive part. And I would imagine the people who work on the defensive side in the agency would probably agree with me about that. So some sort of a review process, I suppose, would be one way to start getting that balance right. But, the book, I'll sort of spoiler alert on it, I guess, is it's short on policy prescriptions. I'm also not a policy maker. I think that what I'm sort of suggesting is that we've swung too far in one direction and we need to sort of try to get back to some sort of a middle ground. I don't know who should be the arbiter of that process, but clearly it seems to me that the NSA is too vested of an interest in that and is conflicted to be doing that. So somewhere in government there has to be someone who is making the call of what to disclose and what not. The one thing I do sort of argue pretty forcefully in the book is that we should not be afraid of offensive cyber. We should be not necessarily embracing cyber warfare and saying, let's go to cyber war, but recognizing that it's a real capability that we need to have, but that it should be vested in the military. And I mean, I make the argument that it should not be something that is being run by an intelligence agency.
So we've had a lot of cyber books over the last few years. There's the Richard Clark Knaik book. There's Joel Brenner's book, America the Vulnerable. Cyber has been a mainstay for the last several years of the national security literature. There's a lot of academic work. What's different about At War?
I think those are both of those books that you mentioned, and I'm particularly a fan of Joel's book, were a lot about the vulnerabilities, right? They were sort of saying, this is all the places where we are weak in cyberspace, where we can be attacked, where we can be exploited, where our secrets can be stolen, where our infrastructure can be threatened. This book is really about, so what do we do about it? What are companies and what are government agencies doing in response to that threat? Which is why a lot of it does focus on the offensive side. I mean, I haven't seen a lot of books probing deeply into the offensive component. And I say in the beginning of the book that I think that U.S. officials like to talk more now openly about the ways that we're vulnerable and that we're victimized, because it does drum up support among policymakers and legislators for getting behind a robust cybersecurity program and giving it, frankly, more money. What we're not looking at is the offensive side of that equation and how we are actually amassing the same capabilities to do to our adversaries what we say they are doing to us, and in which, in some cases, what they are actually doing to us. So I think it's different in that respect, too, sort of looking at the U.S. not just as a victim in cyberspace, but as an aggressive force as well.
So one way it also seems to me to be different, and I will be honest, I haven't read the book in its entirety yet, though I have read the beginning, is that you are not first and foremost, as you say, a policy guy. You're first and foremost a sort of national security storyteller. Mm-hmm. And this is a very narrative book. Walk us through the basic storyline. This is a book that tells a big story. And, you know, take us through it a little bit.
Yeah. I guess there's sort of – there's the book begins in 2007 when the CEOs of the major defense companies, the Lockheed Martins and the Boeings and the Raytheons, are brought to a – classified threat briefing at the Pentagon. They're not exactly sure why they're there, but they're looking around thinking, well, if we're all here in one place, this is probably not good news. They're taken into a SCIF, which is, you know, the secure facility that's impervious to eavesdropping, and they're given a threat briefing that shows that Chinese spies have penetrated the networks of these major American companies and that they are stealing secrets about the work that they're doing for government agencies. So that spies have basically made an end run around the Pentagon and are stealing weapons plans and defense information from the companies. And it's sort of a come to Jesus kind of moment where the Pentagon is saying to these guys, look, you are the weak link in the chain right now, and you are going to have to start ramping up your security, and you are going to start cooperating with us to do that.
And just to be clear, the issue on the table that was stolen at that time is the F-35, the plans for the F-35 strike fighter.
Correct.
Strike fighter.
Correct.
It's a big deal in terms of its the magnitude of the magnitude of the military secret that was lost as a result of these attacks.
Absolutely. And you know, the Joint Strike Fighter is essentially a big flying computer. It's comprised of tens of thousands of lines of software code. It's a very, as the military would say, a target-rich environment for a hacker. And these secrets were being stolen, and the whole integrity of the program was being compromised. And as the Defense Department looked deeper into this, they found that it wasn't just the Joint Strike Fighter program, but like lots of defense contractors were being probed and in some cases breached by spies. So what begins here is kind of it's the seeds of this military internet complex that I'm talking about, where you've got these people in the room, these CEOs, who are the military industrial complex that Eisenhower articulated in his farewell speech in 61. Now these two sides are going to have to come together to protect against this threat. Then the book, though, sort of, you know, goes into the offensive part of that very quickly. So with the reader introduced to this notion of how the U.S. government and its partners in industry are vulnerable in cyberspace, and they're starting. And I tried to sort of, you know, describe cyberspace as this place where real information is being stolen, where computers are connected to networks and people are getting into those systems and taking information. So you kind of are visualizing the consequences of hacking, and so cyberspace is in this abstract domain now. Then I pivot towards quickly the offensive side of things, and that's where I tell the story of our first real big foray into cyber warfare, which was in Iraq during the surge in 2007.
So this chapter, which is the one that I've read most carefully, is quite a surprise. You know, I fashion myself relatively well-educated on these issues, and I had no idea that as much of U.S. targeting practice was based on hacking and stolen information as you describe. You know, tell us a little about that.
Well, this here is this is a story as well that I for a number of years I had been hearing from people in the intelligence community and the military, sort of two sort of threads of murky kind of information. One was this sort of boilerplate thing that you would hear from people, including, you know, military officers when they would give speeches saying, you know, well, we're fighting an intelligence-driven war in Iraq, and, you know, intelligence has been crucial to our success in Iraq. And it just sounds so pat. It almost sounds like you're sort of, you know, giving the thumbs up to the guys on the intel side. That, but, you know, but there was also these rumors that I was hearing from fewer people and in more sort of quietly that you should really look into what the NSA did in Iraq. You should really look into hacking in Iraq. You should really look into this thing called Obelisk. There were all these weird sort of, you know, phrases being thrown around. And the more I looked into it, what I realized is that when the officials publicly were talking about the intelligence successes in Iraq, they were referring to something very specific that the NSA did in Iraq.
Because when normally when I hear in reference to counterterrorism operations or, for that matter, the surge in Iraq, when you hear intelligence-driven, you think in terms of sort of classic signals intelligence, you know, voice communications or email communications that you can steal, and you think in terms of interrogation. You're capturing a large number of people, you're interrogating them, you're putting all this sort of all-source intelligence into a big soup, and you're figuring out what you can find out. But you're describing something very different, mm-hmm. which is offensive hacking operations.
Yeah. So the NSA had a program called the Real-Time Regional Gateway, or the RTRG. Some troops in the field actually refer to it as RT-10, I've subsequently found out. What this was a system that allowed the NSA to own the networks of Iraq. They were able to intercept every cell phone call, every text message, every email, all of the content, all of the metadata. And what they did with this was to start to build a picture of how these insurgents were communicating via their network. So there was a SIGINT, you know, kind of signals intelligence component to it. But more than that, they broke into these networks. They did things like sending text messages to individual fighters that appeared to come from fighters whom they knew, directing them to say, meet us, you know, effectively on this corner at such and such a time. And when they got there, they were greeted by U.S. troops and they were captured. Implanting spyware in websites and in forums that jihadis were known to use and also al-Qaeda in Iraq so that their computers would become infected and could be turned into beacons so that we could actually track these guys down with combat forces. I mentioned earlier something called Obelisk. Obelisk was the name that our intelligence analysts gave to effectively al-Qaeda in Iraq's corporate internet, a place where they posted messages. They would even have mundane things like corporate expense reports, you know, for operations up here. We got into that system as well. So hacking through all of this gave us the ability to not only see what they were doing, but build a diagram of their networks, manipulate them with false information, and ultimately the fruit of that spying is what we then were able to, NSA was then able to give to the guys on the ground, particularly the Joint Special Operations Command, Operations Forces, to then go out and get these guys.
So do you have a sense of what, you know, the conventional narrative of the surge is we put a lot of troops down on the ground and we worked with the Sunni tribes, flipped them against al-Qaeda, big force multiplier, them plus our own forces, produced this very different outcome, this very good, although quite temporary outcome. Do you have a sense of how we should amend that conventional narrative to take into account the cyber operations?
Yeah. I mean, I think that it was a deciding factor in turning the tide of the war. I think that absent this intelligence process, you know, this cyber component, our forces would have lacked the information to give to those extra boots on the ground to then go and round up those fighters. You know, the people I talked to who were deeply involved in this credit this with being a deciding factor. David Petraeus is publicly credited with being a deciding factor. I think the figure he gave was that it was responsible for directly removing 4,000 insurgents from the battlefield, which is not to say that the Sunni awakening was not important. But I think that there's a reexamination now that we should do to say that, you know, absent this cyber component, I don't think the entire surge strategy works. And, you know, I tell a story in the book as well about a meeting that took place in the White House in May of 2007. President Bush and all of his top counterterrorism and national security advisors were there, including Mike McConnell, who at the time was the director of national intelligence and was himself a former NSA director. And it was McConnell who proposed this idea of having the NSA conduct these offensive operations against the Iraqi adversaries. He'd had some experience with this at NSA, obviously, as well. But I think that he recognized that as part of this surge, we should be doing this other thing, too, to give those extra troops on the ground the information that they were going to need. And this is distinct from just monitoring people's phone calls, right? This is hacking an entire country's communication system and getting inside it and owning it and manipulating people with it. It's an extraordinary thing that they did.
So when you read the Snowden revelations about more mundane, you know, non-tactical battlefield ownership of foreign communications networks, does that strike – is that a parallel track, or is that the sort of grandchild of this that NSA has, you know, sort of now tried to own – you know, on a more routine basis, the foreign networks of certain countries? Or is this a really distinct set of operations?
I think those things that you're referring to are like the grandchildren of this. You know, this system that they built, the real-time regional gateway, was a real infrastructure. I mean, there was hardware and software and networking equipment put in Iraq to do that. I have to believe that it's grown more sophisticated, but as evidenced by the fact that we're clearly covering the Snowden documents anyway, covering whole networks in countries where I doubt that we have that level of physical presence. But Iraq was – you'll hear a lot of people in the community say this – was formative to the way that the NSA gathers intelligence. It was very instructive in this sort of collect all of the data, big data kind of hoovering it up and analyzing it, that Keith Alexander was really a big proponent of. So I think that if you look at these other instances of us going in and sort of owning whole networks and tapping into that infrastructure, I think you can look at Iraq as sort of, you know, the pilot case for that.
So talk about the corporations. We have massive capability at NSA, but we also have corporations that aren't in a position to rely on NSA because NSA doesn't protect individual
right.
corporations. So part of the story that you're telling is a kind of mercenary and self-help story. Now, this relates closely to some of the thesis that Gabby Bloom and I have been working on in our forthcoming book. But, you know, what's the story here? We've got, you know, companies that are a little bit like classic privateers and who are conducting something that's kind of like military operations on behalf of other companies, but also on behalf of the government.
Right. And I actually have a chapter where I call it the mercenaries, which, you know, hopefully some of them won't take too much offense at that. But I think that, you know, one of the things that I didn't appreciate when I started researching the book was the extent to which many, many companies that are the target of espionage and hackers have just come to the conclusion that the government is not going to help them. It is not coming to their rescue. There's a great little scene in the book where in 2012, the major U.S. banks are under this massive denial of service attack targeted at their websites. And they go to this Homeland Security official who I interviewed for the book and they say, well, what are you going to do about this? And he looks at them and he says, we can't do anything. What do you expect us to do? This whole industry has grown up that tackles the whole problem from a number of dimensions. So you have companies like one that's really famous is Mandiant, which is this, for lack of a better description, I think it's like a cyber intelligence company. They came out a couple of years ago with a really, really highly detailed report about a unit of hackers in China that were working for the People's Liberation Army. The level of detail in that report is something that 5 years ago you would have probably only seen in a classified government briefing. So companies have gotten really good at understanding the nature of the threat.
And some of them aren't even companies. I mean, before there was Mandiant's APT-1 report, there was the GhostNet report
right.
from the SecDev group, which is, as best as I can tell, a sort of university-based group of researchers in
right.
Toronto.
Exactly.
Who kind of did the same thing to an ongoing Chinese espionage operation.
Right. Absolutely. And Citizen Lab, and I think they're all those guys up there were doing this kind of threat intelligence analysis. And when it comes out, they're thinking like, wow, wait, how do you know all this? Well, they're looking at the networks too. This is this domain is open for all comers. The NSA benefits from being able to hack into other systems. And this is one of the reasons why NSA officials will look at the Mandiants of the world and they will say, but they don't know everything that we know. But of course, that's also how they derive a lot of their sort of power in their aura is by making sure that you think that they need you, which a lot of the companies that I talk to, frankly, think that the government doesn't have much to tell them that they don't already know because they're getting it from these private sources and sometimes from their own analysis. I mean, near the end of the book, I have a chapter where I went out to Lockheed Martin's sort of big cyber operations center near Washington. It's out in Gaithersburg in this sort of low-slung building next to a car dealership and a Toys R Us in this like very suburban area. But they have this whole massive network operations center monitoring their networks all over the world, which of course are under constant, assault by people who are trying to get in. What they told me was that they believe they are now, based on their conversations with people in government, tracking roughly the same number of individual hacker campaigns as the NSA is tracking,
wow.
which is extraordinary considering 8 years ago it was Lockheed Martin that was getting owned by the hackers and having the information stolen. They've flipped that now and become this whole center of expertise that they want to now market to public utilities. They want to protect other companies. I think that the companies who've been victimized by this the most are probably some of the smartest ones out there. And then, of course, we have other companies that sort of operate in a sort of a more shadowy kind of place. I mean, I write a little bit about a company called Endgame, which for a number of years was sort of one of the leaders in collecting zero-day information. Zero days are flaws in software or an operating system that has not yet been discovered by the developer. They're only known to the hacker who discovered them, and so there's 0 days to defend against it. They would sell subscriptions to known zero-day vulnerabilities. One of their biggest customers was the NSA. That's information that you can turn into a cyber weapon. Now, the company has now been trying to get out of that business because they think that it's not sustainable and that the government is really a difficult customer. But there are other companies out there and private researchers as well that sell this information, including in these quasi-underground online markets. And in those, the NSA is, as far as we know, the single largest purchaser of that information.
And there are also, in a different zone, there are companies like Facebook, which pay bounties to any hacker who manages to find a vulnerability in Facebook, as long as you agree not to publish it and not to exploit it. And, and there are thousands of people around the world who make an above board living by trying to hack Facebook.
Absolutely. And the bug bounties, as you hear them called too. Google has a team of people who do this. A couple of my sources told me that about Endgame, Google is becoming one of Endgame's biggest customers. So Google will go out there and pay other people to do it. And, it's kind of, I guess, like in a way, it's like paying you know, scouts, you know, to go out there and find out who your enemies are. You know, there's a longstanding practice of this in the corporate world of human intelligence. I mean, I know someone whose business is he's basically a corporate spy. I mean, companies pay him to go gather information on their competitors, and sometimes he does that through public records, and sometimes he does that by, you know, kind of you know, pretending that he's a member of a golf club and conning his way onto the green and listening to what two executives from the rival company are saying that day. It's not a lot different, I guess, in the cyber domain. You're paying people to go out and find information that could be a threat to you and that could be an advantage to you.
So you have, on the one hand, very well publicized and generally quite accepted sense of grave vulnerabilities in our government and corporate computer systems, in the systems that drive our critical infrastructure, in our military systems, etc. On the second hand, you have truly awesome government capabilities on the offensive side. And on the third hand, you have companies that have developed pretty astonishing and impressive defensive capabilities, including defensive capabilities that are essentially offensive in terms of the ability to go after the people who are going after their clients.
Mm-hmm.
The conventional wisdom is that offense is currently outpacing defense. Do you agree with that? And more generally, how is defense doing? Is it starting to catch up?
I think I generally do agree that it's outpacing defense. And one recent example that I guess I point to that helped drive that home is the hacking of JP Morgan about a month or so ago, I guess it was now. It's kind of easy to overlook that as, oh, yeah, yes, another large company got hacked. But the thing about that was so surprising to a lot of people, I think, was that the banks were believed to have the best defense. You know, banks really invest a lot of money. I think Jamie Dimon has said that JP Morgan invests about $250 million a year in computer security and network defense, and I think he plans on doubling that. It's an extraordinary amount of money, and people generally believe that the banks were the best at defense, and yet they too were penetrated. And apparently the hackers who got inside for whatever reason didn't go further, but they might have been able to. What I think all of this is going to fuel, though, is a push by the victims to be allowed to go on the offense or to engage in, as they would say, self-defense. I mean, the NSA has a term for this already called active defense. Active defense basically is a form of self-defense. I'm going to hit you before you hit me. And of course, right now, it's illegal for a company to hack back at someone who is coming after them. It's illegal for them to go break into the databases of whomever ripped them off and take the information back. It's probably illegal to even lace certain documents on their network with malicious software so that if the hacker takes it, it infects their system. And yet these are all things that companies want to do. They're things that I think some companies are doing right now. I think that because the defenses aren't working enough and people are still getting owned and still getting violated, there's this momentum towards sort of taking the gloves off. And the companies I talk to, you know, people who were, you know, in industries that have been targeted by this, and particularly in the financial sector, their attitude is if the government really wants to help us, stop giving us threat signatures that are outdated the day that we get them. Stop telling us about hacking campaigns. We can get that from our private intel guys. Go out and get the guys who are doing this. Go take them down. Take them offline. Effectively attack them. I'm not sure there is great appetite right now in the National Security Agency to do that, to engage in offensive cyber warfare on the behalf of U.S. companies. And I think the companies generally know that, which is why there's this momentum towards wanting to be able to hack back on their own. And I came away actually with, I suppose, some level of sympathy for that position because, you know, if someone breaks into your house and steals your television set and starts rifling through all your personal belongings, the law, it differs from state to state, but generally makes, you know, it gives you grounds for self-defense. to repel that intruder. And if you, we don't have to take it necessarily to the extent of lethal force, maybe, but you have some rights.
Actually, in your house, in most jurisdictions, to the extent that you feel threatened, you have the right to use lethal force against an intruder.
Right. And if you take that to the cyber analogy, then the companies would say, if we're being hacked, why shouldn't we be able to fire back where we know the source is and take that person offline, disable that computer? We're not talking about killing anyone in this context, although I think there are probably people who you could hire to go out and find the people who are hacking you and make them physically very uncomfortable.
Yeah. Gabby and I make a similar argument that, you know, in an environment in which the government is not prepared to protect you, it can't too readily encumber the right of self-defense. And I think there's a, you know, at least to the extent that you're talking about relatively passive self-defense measures like putting, you know, honeypots on your own systems that will be destructive if moved to somebody else's systems. It's very hard to argue, to at least to me, that that should be illegal.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I mean, I think that we need to, if the law needs to be adjusted or made clearer on this as a way of giving companies some extra layer of protection, I think that's a conversation we should have, you know, before something happens like, you know, a bank really gets pissed off because it's the 10th time they've been hit by Iran and decides to take matters into its own hands, and suddenly you've got, you know, JP Morgan launching a private cyber war against the, you know, the government of Iran. I think we want to avoid that outcome. So we should start talking about what rights companies have to protect themselves, and it's their property that's being stolen.
So where is this all going? Are we you know, is there reason to be hopeful at this point, or is this a counsel for despair?
No, I think there's reason to be hopeful. I think that, you know, we're at the very beginning of a new era in intelligence, in war, in national security law. I think the important thing to do now is to start thinking about how we want to sort of thinking about the different lanes of the cyber domain. You know, I guess I'm generally speaking comfortable with the idea that agencies like the NSA should be engaged in intelligence operations, but that we should have the military taking over more of this offensive component of cyber warfare. And I think that that's generally where I think the military is trying to go. And we do have now, I guess it's about 4 years old, a U.S. cyber command. We are creating a combatant command to be the center of gravity of cyber operations for the military.
Although it's co-located with NSA and it shares a director.
It shares a director. And I think that's another that, – and that's a, I'll make a bet that Mike Rogers, the current NSA director and cyber commander, will be the last person to be dual-hatted in that position. There are a lot of people I talk to who – are, you know, who are not antagonistic towards the NSA and that mission, but who don't think that that person should be dual-hatted. And I personally don't think he should be either.
Including former Director Hayden.
Correct. Yeah, it shouldn't be the same person. I know why they did it that way, and it was perhaps necessary to get it off the ground. Maybe not. But it shouldn't stay that way. We're not going to, though, we're not entering an era where, as I think maybe 5 or 10 years ago, people would have imagined when we talked about these subjects that all wars of the future are just going to be fought on the internet and fought in cyberspace. That we'll, you know, we'll just fight China remotely through our computers and we won't actually face people on a battlefield. I think what's going to happen is that cyber is going to become incorporated into the way we fight. The military talks about it as a fifth domain of warfare after land, air, sea, and outer space. They're envisioning a future in which we have teams of trained hackers, or if you want to call them cyber warriors, that are brought up in a specialty just the same way as you train somebody to work in the infantry or you train someone to be a pilot or a submarine driver. We're going to this integrated approach. We're not ditching all of our forms of warfare in favor of the cyber warfare dimension, cyber warfare. And I think the final thing I'd say on where this is going is a lot of the expertise in how to do this and a lot of the responsibility for protecting American networks is going to shift to the private sector. I think that really the government, if they really, you know, many people in government don't really want to be responsible for that. I mean, Keith Alexander, who was the last NSA director, kind of, I think, had a very ambitious view of what NSA should be doing to protect private industry. There are a lot of people who don't share that view, including people who work in the Homeland Security Department, which is nominally responsible for interfacing with the private sector. I would imagine that in 5 years, banks are going to be marketing their cyber defenses the way that they market their customer service, saying, come to us. You know, we're really good at repelling the hackers. We haven't been hacked in 3 years. We haven't had credit card information violated in how many days? I see a lot of that shifting over to the private sector, which, if you think about it, is probably only natural because most of the networks in this country are privately owned. That may change if we start to treat the internet as a utility, which I think President Obama this week hinted that he would like to do. But for now, I see just a lot of this energy moving into to private hands and individuals just getting a lot smarter about what cybersecurity means for them and taking it personally and incorporating it into their daily lives.
So what do you do personally and how do you incorporate it into your daily life?
I don't use the internet. No, I'm kidding. I keep my money in mattresses. I think I take some pretty basic steps that are probably rare for most of the population now, but shouldn't be. I use a password locker, which is a device that keeps all my passwords in one place, and they're randomly generated and very hard to guess. And it's all governed by a master password that's nearly impossible to guess. I use encryption in certain circumstances. I'm very careful about how I communicate with my sources and trying to do that in ways that that don't leave indelible trails. I don't open attachments that come to me that I don't know where they came from. Sort of like basic kind of steps that I think as time goes on are going to be the equivalent of looking both ways when crossing the street and don't go in certain neighborhoods after dark and make sure you lock your door. I don't think that what I'm doing is particularly novel, and I'm sure there are many ways that if Chris Segoyan were here would tell me, you get a C- in personal cybersecurity, you're doing a terrible job. But at least I'm trying to do something, and I'm taking it seriously and actively paying attention to it all the time.
Next week we'll have Chris in to rate Shane Harris's cybersecurity and see if he does better than a C-. Shane, thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks, Ben. I was glad to be here for number 100, and congratulations to you and Lawfare.
Thank you. I hope you come back before number 1,000.
Yeah, you can count on it.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with, bet you can't guess, the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to the folks in the Brookings studio who hosted Shane and me. Our music, as ever, is performed by the infamous Sophia Yan, who always says about cyber war,
"We? What? Me? We can't do anything. What do you expect us to do?"
You are responsible for promoting the Lawfare podcast. You've been doing a good job. You could be doing a better job. So tweet us, share us on Facebook, be annoying at dinner parties with your friends. Spread the word. Thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.